And now Sunday night,
as you're listening to Coast with Ian Punnett, as you're ready to fall off into sleep, officially Sunday at 2 a.m., Saturday night to Sunday at 2 a.m., turn your clock back 1 hour. We're getting off daylight saving time. It's one of the longest in history. This new time where it picks it up in March and now goes to November 1st. So Sunday night, 2 a.m. Actually, it's Saturday night into Sunday morning, 2 a.m. So you set it, you wake up Sunday morning, you'll be all set. Turn your clock back 1 hour. We'll take your calls next hour with Michael Heiser. Michael, several years ago, you were part of the Godman and ET conference with Richard C. Hoagland. I want to talk with you about that. But also, you went to an X conference in Washington, D.C., where you kind of debated somewhat the late Father Corrado Balducci. Tell me about that, because he was, again, one of those at the Vatican, staunch believer in ET presence.
Right. At the X conference, Father Balducci and myself, for your listeners, it wasn't an organized debate. We both had sessions there. And, naturally there are going to be people who go to both because they were not scheduled at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm quite sure that we took the same sort of questions, the same probably set of questions, from some people, and I would answer some of those questions differently than Father Balducci would. So, I could see where people, could come away from that, noting, areas of disagreement between us. And I'm glad you mentioned the Godman ET thing. That really brings back good memories, because I caught Richard earlier tonight.
That was a great conference.
Yeah, I haven't talked to Richard for quite a while. It was nice to hear what he's up to. And I've been to his website a little bit, but I don't catch him that often.
He's still in the trenches, and what's fascinating, Michael, is every time something breaks about Mars, he said it on this program years ago.
Yeah, he has a pretty good track record for anticipating those sorts of things, and so I do go to his website whenever there's something in the news and see if he's either responding to it or pointing back to something or something of that nature. So he has a good track record of that.
Let's talk a little bit, if we can, about Zachariah Sitchin, author of The 12th Planet and a number of other books related to that. His theory is that he believes that the Sumerians interpreted, had texts that have now been interpreted, that the Anunnaki came down from another planet, the 10th planet at the time, Nibiru, and they were mining for gold. They genetically altered what was on this planet that became us, and the rest, of course, is history. You differ from that, don't you?
Yes, I do.
Maybe considerably.
Yeah, that's putting it pretty well. That's pretty accurate. So that's a good way to put it. I do. I'm sort of a text geek, and so, I'm less interested, even though I am interested, but I'm less interested in theorizing about the text and what's actually in them. That's sort of the stick in the mud part of my personality, I guess. But I look at something like Nibiru, and we've done shows on this before, and there isn't a whole lot published on Nibiru. Most of it's in German, and I think in past shows I've made some of that available to listeners. But on my website, you can get to anything I say about Sitchin through michaelsheiser.com. I sort of have a table of all the occurrences of Nibiru that are known and that are discussed in the literature in cuneiform tablets. And I have a table up there. And you'll find, if you actually look at where Nibiru is mentioned, that it's never a planet outside, the known planets, so something beyond Saturn. It actually does get equated with Jupiter and Mercury, which is really odd because, can't they make up their mind? There's two different planets there. It's also called a star, and it's also something that is referenced and seen in connection with the Mesopotamian, the Babylonian, in this case, New Year. So it's an annual sort of sighting, an annual sort of event that whatever Nibiru is, it's connected with. I have sort of my own gut feeling as to what is going on with Nibiru, but the texts don't say that it cycles, you know, every 3,600 years through the solar system. It's not, you know, a planet beyond the ones that the Sumerians knew, because they do identify it with Jupiter and with Mercury and two different texts. And I think they kind of struggle, too, as to, you know, how to identify it. My gut reaction is that I think it has something to do with the cycling through of the Babylonian zodiac, you know, which, of course, is an annual sort of thing. And Sitchin is correct in his books when he refers to Nibiru as having something to do with a crossing, or the place of the crossing, or right. Something like that. And I think it has something to do where the sequence of constellations, you know, cross the ecliptic, you know, on an annual basis. I think that's why it gets mentioned annually. But to be perfectly honest with your audience, there isn't a whole lot of work done on Nibiru, and so there's a lot of guesswork that's going on. The Sumerian material, the Mesopotamian material, just doesn't have a whole lot of reference to it. And so, you know, I more or less just object to making too much out of the material that isn't there in terms of speculation and interpretation and things like that.
Give me your take, your feelings on ETs, what you think they are.
If it could be a number of possibilities, and for your listeners, I actually have this spelled out on my UFO religions blog. You could go up there and take a look at...
And how do we get to that?
You can go to michaelshizer.com and then look for
all right. And you have blog. You have to put the S in there.
Yeah, Michael.
And you run them all together, no periods or anything like that.
Or you can Google it, too. If you put UFO religions in my last name, you're going to find the blog.
Okay.
There aren't too many UFO religions blogs out there. So that was part of the logic, too. You know, what can I call this thing that people can find it? But anyway, I think if we're... You could have, you know, beings... You know, from another planet, okay, and I define ET or alien as, you know, what we typically discuss together and on the show, as a life form that has a definite lifespan, has to eat, has to drink, has to reproduce, to maintain a species, and, you know, all the things that a physical life form, you know, is subject to.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's one category. Another possibility is some sort of, again, you know, you get this interdimensional idea. Another possibility is that there's sort of a crossover in terminology between what people think are, you know, life forms with definite lifespans, physical life forms, and they're actually, again, for lack of a better term, these spiritual entities. You know, but of course, an hour ago, I pointed out that if you're going to take biblical theology seriously, all that stuff's made of something. So I actually prefer an interdimensional. I don't claim to understand, you know, the term. I'm not a physicist, but I use it because it's familiar. But some other plane of reality. I do believe that there is this other plane of reality. I think the Bible is clear on that. Other ancient texts are quite clear on that. And so I think that's the best alternative, because what I need, you know, personally, I'm perfectly willing, you know, to go with the first one, you know, that there's actual extraterrestrial life forms out there. But I need physical evidence of, you know, one of those life forms, something that's just incontrovertible.
Do you believe we've been visited?
I believe we've been visited in terms of beings from the second category. And I would switch over, you know, to the first category if there were physical evidence of that. And a lot of the God-man ET thing, at least my contribution to it, was laying out the discussion that has occurred theologically within the Judeo-Christian world over the centuries, over whether this is, pardon the pun, whether this is kosher or not. And, you know, for the most part, theologians, at least those who orient themselves according to the Bible, have had no problem with this, because, you know, to say that God couldn't have created, you know, such beings is a limitation on his omnipotence. And it became known as the principle of plenitude, that, you know, God, we have to let God exercise the fullness of his power, and this certainly comes under it. And so there really wasn't an objection to this from the Middle Ages on, and that's why I said, you know, earlier that the Catholic Church's announcement, I think, is very consistent with earlier church thinking on this. Now, in our day and age, you know, the late 20th century, early 21st century, religious people are often troubled by the discussion because they mentally can only equate this with something demonic. I don't think that's warranted. You have all the categories out there. You sort of got to pick one now, but it could be any one of these things or nothing at all. I mean, we have to leave that as a possibility as well. But, you know, to say it can only be this and this is the only way to account for it, I don't think is the right way to go. But the other thing that bothers religious people is that it's often connected with panspermia and evolution, that if somehow we were to find genuine extraterrestrial life, that somehow is a smack against, you know, an ultimate creator God and the biblical view of origins. I don't think that's true at all. And a lot of my talks on this subject, really, I try to disabuse the audience of you know, being narrow in that way and in terms of their thinking about this, because the church has processed this for a long time. Islam, of course, has been there for a long time. Islam has other worlds. Incidentally, yeah. Your audience is going to like this. The Quran has Adam created off-planet. You know, which a lot of people don't realize.
Now tell me that. Explain that one.
Yeah, they have. It's a very sort of suggestive thing because Adam is created and then he's brought
here,
right, to the earth, and so and that's really all it said. So it creates the suggestion. It's not explicit, but it creates the suggestion that Adam was created off planet.
All right. How is it? How is that written, though? Kind of tell us the story.
Well, I'd have to actually look that up in the.
Okay.
Basically, it's you know, kind of interesting, actually.
Yeah, I mean, does it say who brought him here?
No, it just says that Allah, of course, is involved in the creation, but you also get intermediate beings. In Islamic theology, they're called the jinn, and they have some sort of role. Again, it's not explicit again. This is a lot like the Anunnaki, because if you actually read through the Mesopotamian material and the creation of humankind, the Anunnaki don't actually create humans, but they're sort of in the room. They're observing what's going on because we have, you know, the mixing of the clay and the blood of, you know, one god and all that kind of stuff. And they're sort of in the room, like approving, you know, what's going on. And then they say, well, this is wonderful. This is great. You know, now we have a servant and all this kind of stuff. You get the same kind of feel from the Quran that the jinn, who are not Allah, and they're not angels, they're something else. Again, very powerful beings, but
right.
they're there. Doesn't give them credit, necessarily. You know, credit has to go to Allah.
Almost. You know, we had Rosemary Ellen Guiley on last night, Michael, and
oh, yeah?
She talked about the jinn, and she said that, you know, they're somewhat dimensional-type figures. Maybe,
yeah,
huh?
Well, that's not a really foreign or bad description to use, because the jinn and the Quran just kind of come and go
at will.
You know, they're at one location, then they're at a different location instantly. You know, so that would be, in our terminology, you know, that would be a good way for a 21st century person to sort of process, you know, what's going on there. But, you know, you get, there's some similarities there that are kind of interesting. I don't know how we got that far down that path, George, but there we are.
It's not a bad path.
But, yeah, I have, you know, back to the original Anunnaki thing, I do have differences. I really try to stick with the text. I don't want to say anything that the text doesn't. When I'm speculating about the text, I try to tell people I'm doing that. But I like to just stick with what the texts say. And so that's really where my fundamental disagreements with Sitchin are. I'm just a servant of the text, or at least I try to be. I try to not say what a Mesopotamian wouldn't say, not fill in those gaps for them.
I always used to remember Hoagland telling Art Bell, Brookings, it's Brookings, which, of course, he was making reference to that 1960 study that concluded that if E.T. were disclosed, mainstream institutions, religions wouldn't be able to handle it, and people wouldn't be able to handle it. Religions would collapse, and there'd be social chaos. Do you believe that?
You know, I think there I think that is true, but to a much smaller extent, a much smaller scale than would have been true in the 60s.
I agree. It's been 48 years, almost 50 years later.
Yeah,
things have changed here.
Yeah, it's one of those, yeah, this would happen, but I think it would be very, very scaled down. I think for what it was in the 60s, that was a pretty accurate, estimation of what the reaction would be. But I just can't imagine that today there would be that kind of reaction on a very large scale. You'd certainly get it, but I'm just not buying that it really applies today to the same extent.
What do you think of the work of SETI?
Well, I think it's worthwhile. I know SETI gets picked on a lot because, of lack of results and mm-hmm. whatnot. And, to some extent I agree, this is a presupposition that if there was intelligent life out there, it would use radio waves or radio signals to do what they're, to establish contact. I'll admit that's a leap, that's a jump. And other people, of course, argue we should be looking at other things. But, I think it's probably a good strategy in the sense that it's something that can be funded. It has, some capability of success, some small probability of success. So why not? It's not as big as a lot of other things. And I think it keeps public interest in space, and I think that's important, for funding other things. It's not just about SETI. It's about, other forms of exploration. If that's what draws people in and keeps people interested and that helps with funding, the bigger picture, then I think it's worthwhile.
What interests you, these different facets that you investigate, ancient ETs, these texts, ghosts? Is there a specialty there for you?
Well, I don't really go after, the ET question. It's sort of something that's peripheral, that pops up because, my own specialty is divine beings, angels, demons, that sort of thing in ancient texts. And since that material gets processed by people, like Zechariah Sitchin, who are researchers, and also just people on the lay level, on the audience level, I sort of get drawn into that. And that's really what happened with the facade, and so I'm willing to go there because people, read a lot of that stuff. They ask a lot of those questions. I care about whether texts get, treated well, get treated properly, because that that is my field. I care about it. I want people to be reading this stuff, and I don't want it to be mishandled. So I get drawn into it. I have academics from time to time ask me why I do this, because it's such a waste of time, and my answer is pretty much always the same. If I were a doctor and there was somebody going around saying, well, take this and it'll cure that, and I know it won't, well, I have an obligation to say something. Same thing in the legal field.
Sure.
If I'm a scholar and this is my area, and I think that people are getting information that isn't accurate, well, I have an obligation. It's just, this is what I do. There aren't many people who really bother to go into this, and so I feel a sense of obligation to say something and get involved.
Do you ever investigate the work of the Mayas?
I do not do much of that. That's probably something. It's something I'd like to do, but since I don't have a grasp of the language, I haven't really dived in. I like to get a grasp of the language first.
Okay, back to the text when we come back with you, Michael Heiser, on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour we'll take your phone calls with Michael Heiser. He's an accomplished author as well, in addition to his research, The Facade. We talked with him some time ago about it, but let's get an update on UFOs, aliens, Area 51, Roswell. You ready for the truth? The Facade, next on Coast to Coast AM. I guess, part of this book, The Facade, that you wrote, Michael, which is a great book, by the way. You could call it fiction because you created characters, yet inside of it, everything seems true, which would make it nonfiction, I think.
Yeah, it is one of those faction sort of sort of books. I mean, it is a novel, but it's not just marketing shtick. You know, inside the book, one of the first things the reader hits is a statement that everything in the book is real. I mean, every ancient text I reference is real. Every government document actually exists. Every technology actually exists. It's kind of interesting, since the facade, you know, came out initially in 2001, there have been three or four very specific things in the book that have wound up in the news. One is the connection of panspermia, the directed panspermia, intelligent panspermia, that be something that the mainstream scientific community would entertain. That has come to pass. The creation of synthetic life, that has a part in the book, that's come to pass. And there are just data points like that, that my goal was to make all the data points real. And the only thing that's fictional about the book are the characters and essentially how I connect the dots for the sake of the story. The story, you know, gets the data out there. It's sort of a primer on all sorts of different subjects that your audience is familiar with, but other readers may not be. And it weaves them all together, and everything in the book is real except for the story. It's just kind of an odd, you know, sort of mix, but people have really responded to it well and latched onto it. And I get asked about a sequel all the time, and, you know, that actually is in the works. I can't say too much beyond that, but that I have... I'm an outliner. I write my fiction by virtue of outlining. It's just, I think it's part of my academic training. So I've
sure,
got the whole
you
thing
get
outlined.
It organized.
I know how it begins. I know how it ends. I know, you know, specific things that are going to happen and threads and whatnot. All that sort of thing is, for me, the difficulty. The thing that actually remains to, you know, completing it is how far do I want to go with certain ideas because of. In terms of page count, and also how much can you really pack into one of these things and not overwhelm people. The facade has sure. a lot in it, but people really have responded well to it. They can handle the density of the information, and the story is compelling.
Is it controversial in its own way?
You know, it has been. It's one of those things where on the one hand, because one of the elements, of course, you know, since I'm a religion scholar, there's a bit of that in there. There's theology in there, specifically that displeases, you know, certain religious types. And there's essentially two elements that sort of have become controversial. One is, of course, the openness theologically and also in terms of the story. Toward the idea that there could be extraterrestrial life. That's one thing that has bothered some people. The other thing is my own area of academic work, the Divine Council, and that's just a fancy academic term for the heavenly host. Well, the Bible itself describes the heavenly host as a group of gods. I mean, that's Psalm 82, verse 1, you know, just point blank, that's what it is. And, you know, theologically, we can talk about how to process that and what about monotheism and all that kind of stuff. And that's where I spend most of my time as an academic. But I thought I would put that into the book because it becomes important as one of the threads in the plot. But, you know, people aren't used to thinking about that or thinking in those terms. Again, it's something that's obscured by English translation, so people have found that threatening. But a lot of those people have actually gone up to my website and read other things and sort of where I academically sort it out. But you can't take a novel to do all that, you know, sort of thing.
You touch on an area that I truly enjoy, and that's prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
in that. And are you an end times believer?
Yeah, I certainly believe that there is an intelligent plan. God has an intelligent plan toward which he is influencing and steering all things. And one of my issues with the sequel is exactly what to say in that regard, because I don't know if this will be really understandable, but I think you'll get my drift here. I don't want to say too much because since I am an academic, it might be one of those things that sort of sets people off and like, wow, Mike is saying this, even though it's in a novel, Mike said it, and Mike ought to know, and they might just take something a little too zealously or a little too too literally. But at the same time, I actually want to provoke people that way. So it's sort of finding that.
Can't have it both ways, Michael. You got to take a stand.
I know. You sound like Richard now.
That's right.
I'll give you one example. I mean, there is something called astral prophecy that is a known, recognized genre of literature in the ancient Greco-Roman world and the ancient Semitic world. Now, astral prophecy, what in the world is that? Well, if I say the three magi, okay, that's familiar. I mean, they are looking at the heavens, and they are figuring things out as far as the birth of the Messiah and all that sort of thing. We actually know what the Magi saw. How do we know that? Well, it's actually described in the 12th chapter of Revelation. People think because it's in Revelation that it's future. If you actually read the 12th chapter, it references a series of astronomical events associated with the birth of Jesus. So it's actually referencing something in the past, you know, to make, you know, a point about what's coming. But you can actually plot that. Okay, if you buy an astronomy program, you can plot that out and, you know, arrive at a date. And then the next question becomes, well, does that concatenation of astronomical symbolism, is that ever going to happen again, or did it ever happen again after that? And you get into things like that, and that's where, you know, I, as a writer, wonder, should I really spill all that? You know, how much of that do I really want to get into? Because I find it fascinating, but you know, I don't want a following. You know, I don't want to be the, you know,
the guru sort of this.
Yeah,
huh?
I'm just not into that. You know, and it is speculative. I'm not a prophet, and I'm not going to pretend I'm one. But there are just things in the text like that you know, they're there. You know, so. Yeah, you know, I want that material to be in there. I want people to be aware of that, things like that going on in the text. But at the same time, you know, I feel a responsibility to be, you know, a little bit careful. So that's one plot thread. I've just sort of spilled one plot thread that's going to occur in some fashion in the sequel. I just haven't decided exactly how to do it yet.
Do some of these prophecies, have they come true to come to pass yet?
Well, I personally think that prophecy is cyclical, and that what that means in terms of the way we look at history is that you'll often find a description of something that's going to happen, you know, in the Bible, we'll say. You know, I'll just use Antichrist as an example.
Sure.
I mean, there's a whole typology, there's a whole, you know, slew of characteristics, you know, for what this person is going to be like and where he's from and what he's going to do and so on and so forth. Well, the elements of those, even collectively, even bunches of them, bunches of, you know, sorts of things that are said about this great enemy, have emerged and merged into historical people. And some of the things those people do mimic what is supposed to happen, you know, in the end. For instance, you have Antiochus Epiphanes, who was the guy who went into Jerusalem in the intertestamental period, slew a pig on the altar, and he becomes sort of the great enemy figure, and because he fulfills certain things that the Antichrist is supposed to have, you know, done. Well, that part of it happened. Part of it, you know, could happen later. You have prophecies that actually get fulfilled 3-4 times in the Bible because they're sort of like warm-ups. You know, they cycle through history, and you get mirror images of this ultimate thing that's going to happen. And if you want to know what that ultimate thing is going to look like, well, you look back here when you have sort of, you know, warm-ups or just, you know, foreshadowings, you know, of what this is going to be like. So when you ask, has prophecy been fulfilled, I would say, yeah, and it's going to continue to cycle through. Because you even have that happening in the pages of the Bible where things happen more than once and then are still said to be yet future. There's an already but not yet sort of feel to prophecy. And to me, that's what makes it interesting. I think it would be boring, you know, if you could just, you know every you know, when everything's going to happen, time, date, all that kind of thing. You know, there'd be no mystery to it. So I'm perfectly willing to embrace some ambiguity, but also there's patterning that I think is important.
Well, if we did know the future, though, we might be able to fix it, alter it somewhat.
Yeah, we might jump out the window.
Yeah, you know, a little sooner than later.
One of those things, you know, you and I have probably imbibed enough science fiction. You know, we've seen those shows about, well, do you really want to know what your future is?
Exactly.
Maybe, you know?
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing.
I particularly enjoyed also the theories that you had, that you eased into the facade, underground bases. Let's talk a little bit about that for just a second.
Yeah, I used, you know, Mount Weather was sort of current at the time because, you know, we had, of course, the incident, you know, with 9/11 and all the discussion of, you know, are these facilities really there? Well, yeah, lo and behold, they are there. And then people, you know, dug up old articles in Time magazine that said, well, you know, 30 years ago, somebody did an article on this thing, and, you know, why weren't we paying attention? It was a convenient set of circumstances, you know, in our own lifetime where I could use that and again, point people to the fact that, yeah, these places actually do exist. There's one of them, Mount Weather. This isn't the only one, but to actually give people a glimpse into these kinds of programs that are operational. I mean, Richard Souder's book, you've had him on the show.
Yes, sure did.
Before. I mean, he's done a tremendous amount of work, you know, I mean, real work, schematics, diagrams, blueprints, the whole thing. I mean, anybody who's interested in this really needs to look at what he's done here. It's serious. It's real stuff.
Truly incredible.
And into that. Yeah. Yeah, I wanted there to be an awareness there and use that as a plot element as well.
Lots going on near Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
In terms of the bases, lots.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, you always get the ones that are always talked about, you know, Area 51, Mount Weather, that kind of thing. But, you know, you have a whole, I don't want to call it a cottage industry, but you know what I mean. You have a whole building these things, maintaining these things, utilizing these things really keeps a lot of people employed.
Yeah, sure does. Hey, you know, back to the ancient texts and the like, do you think we'll ever find the Ark of the Covenant, Michael?
I tell people it's in my garage.
I wish.
You know, I've gone back and forth about that as far as, you know, did this thing survive? I think there's a good possibility it did. That is not to say, you know, that it's still around. I mean, there are indications in the Bible that it was not destroyed, you know, with the temple in 586 B.C. You've had Graham Hancock on before as a whole book on this, which I generally think Hancock really does a nice job of ferreting out information. I don't always agree with him what he does with it, but I would certainly recommend people looking at Sign of the Seal. It's his book. Lots of good stuff in there. I tend to think that it did survive. My one hesitation is if you go to, and Hancock uses this source, if you go to the journals of somebody known as Abu Salih, 12th, 13th century, someone who, you know, a traveler, kind of like a Marco Polo type, who went to Ethiopia and said he witnessed the bringing out of the Ark, you know, at a New Year's ceremony and event. It's what he describes is the Ark, except that it has a cross affixed to it and other religious symbols. And I'm thinking, you know, if this was really the Ark, would they really touch it? I mean, would they really do this? Would they really alter its design in any way? And so I just wonder. You know, I wonder.
You think not, but you never know.
Yeah, I'll admit that it's possible, but it creates that sort of iffy, has that iffy feel to me. But there's a lot of circumstantial evidence, you know, that unfortunately that's what it is. There's a lot of circumstantial evidence for the Ark surviving. And, you know, being in Africa somewhere, Ethiopia, Addis Ababa, I think that that's possible. But I have this nagging suspicion that if it was taken out, that it's not around anymore. I'll throw this one other thing in Jeremiah chapter 3, right around verse 16.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a prophecy. There is a statement made in that chapter about, you know, when we hit the end times, when we hit the glorious time of the kingdom and so on and so forth, it says something to the effect that no one will ask about the ark anymore. Now, does that mean there isn't one, you know, to worry about? Or does that mean it's just replaced and we just don't need it anymore?
Sure. Well, we keep talking about it.
I noticed you're going to be at the UFO conference in November.
In Las Vegas.
Yes.
Absolutely. I'm going to be up there next Friday, as a matter of fact.
Yeah. I noticed that there would be a paper, your listeners, if they're going, you know, might be interested, on the Majestic documents. You and I had met back in Roswell, not last year, but the year before.
The year before, 60th anniversary, right?
60th anniversary, and I had done some things that, this was facade-related, but it was also subsequent research about getting the Majestic documents tested linguistically. And there's going to be a sort of follow-up to that at that conference. And the woman that I hired to check into the linguistic patterning, the forensic linguistic,
right, I remember that,
material, also examined a document that Bob Wood gave her. And she and I actually had a conversation last week. I'm not going to spill the beans for anybody who's going to the conference, but that is a part of, that's something else I sort of am into, because it's language based. You know, I feel like I have some competence there, and I know people in the field who can get government documents and whatnot tested properly. And her name is Carol Chasky, and Carol is very careful. She's very cautious. So I think the results of her work will generate some interest at the conference.
Looks good. Looks good. But I'm looking forward to the conference. I try to do as many as I can now, Michael, on weekends. How about you? Do you go to many anymore?
I don't actually travel a whole lot. I may go to three or four things a year, something like that. You know, I'm somewhat of a homebody, but you know, I always feel guilty when I travel if I don't get to take a family. But when we met in Roswell, of course, you know, I had some family there, so I didn't feel, you know, as bad about that.
Well, that was a good trip. We're going to take phone calls when you come right back, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to talk about the ancient texts. We'll also talk about, you know, God, Man, and E.T. People can ask you questions about the facade as well. You are one of the heavy hitters when it comes to research, so stick around. Michael Heiser, our guest. You're next. Phone calls with Michael Heiser on Coast to Coast AM.